Okay, we're going to talk today about Chamishasa B'Shvat. The Mishnah indicates that there's a dispute in the first Mishnah and Masechet Rosh Hashanah between B'Shamid B'Sol, right? Between Hill and Shami and Beis Shami, I believe it's between Beis Shami and Beis Hill. I will. The argument is about when precisely the new year for the trees is to be marked. Beis Shammai holds that it's the beginning of Shvat, Rosh Chodesh Shvat, and Beis Hillel holds that it's the 15th day of Shvat, and as is the practice throughout Shas, the decision is in favor of Beis Hillel, and so halachically the new year of trees is marked on the 15th day of Shvat, which is going to be forthcoming this coming Shabbos. Most of us have no difficulty with a new year for people. We understand that that's a time in which people are judged by the Almighty. Kivnei Moren, as the Mishnah indicates, we are judged as though we were all of us marching through before the Almighty, and the Almighty sees us and judges us in one single instant. So we understand that that people are judged. But how is it that we understand Rosh Hashanah for trees? Are we to believe that the trees are judged? So the object here of the mission, of the discussion, has to do with the institution of Trumos and Maisos. Every year, when the Jewish people would grow their crops, their orchards, cultivate their vineyards, so there were laws that related to what they grew. Some of them had to do with the fact that when you gleaned your vineyard or when you harvested your field, that you had to leave certain portions of it unharvested, ungleaned, for the poor. But there were certain percentages that did need to be harvested and gleaned and collected, and you gave roughly 2% to the Kohanim. After you gave the 2% to the Kohanim, you would give a tithe, a tenth, to the Levites. And then you would once again tithe, and depending on where exactly you were in the cycle of the Shemitah, you would give either Maisa Sheni, you didn't give Maisa Sheni, you would set aside Maisa Sheni, which was the second tithe. That was the fruit or the harvest which you would take to Jerusalem, and it had to be consumed in Jerusalem, had to be enjoyed in Jerusalem, or Maiseroni, which was a tithe that was distributed to the poor. Out of the 7-year cycle, 1 year, the fallow year, the 7th year, had no obligations. There, everybody was equal, the rich and the poor. The original landowner and total strangers, everybody had equal access and equal rights to what was in the fields. But within the 6 year leading up to that fallow year, up to the Shemitah, the first and second year, you gave Maisa Rishon, the first tithe which went to the Levi, Maisa Sheni, the second tithe had to be carried to Jerusalem, or else it had to be redeemed for money, and then you had to take the money to Jerusalem and buy food in Jerusalem, which would then be take the place of what you yourself had harvested or grown. The third year and the sixth year, there were, instead of the Maisa Sheni, instead of the second Maisa, there was Maisa Rani, the tithe which you gave to the poor. So the first and second year and the fourth and fifth year were identical, and the third year and the sixth year were identical. I could not fulfill my obligations of giving of the November crop. In other words, I have to give 2% of the, roughly 2% of the November crop to the Kohen. I could not say, you know what, let's leave this. I want to keep the everything that I grew in November for myself. I'm going to take some of the grain that I have stored, that I harvested in June, and I am going to give that to the Kohen to fulfill my obligation. Can't do that. Or the other way around. You cannot give truma to satisfy this year's requirement from a previous year. Conversely, I cannot satisfy last year's requirement for truma by taking off truma from the new crop. The same thing is true of Maisa. The tithe cannot, my obligation, even if I'm going to give the exact same amount, I figured out here's what I'm obligated, I can't satisfy my obligation from this crop by using the produce of another crop, another year's crop. So, when we're dealing with fruit, the point of demarcation is not Rosh Hashanah, but is the 15th day of Shvat. The 15th day of Shvat is the dividing line. That which grows before the 15th day of Shvat belongs to last year. That which grows after the 15th day of Shvat belongs to the new year. And that means that the only way in which I can satisfy my obligation for the that which grows during the new year is by giving from whatever grows after the 15th day of Shvat. Certain fruits would be decided by looking at how much of the growth has taken place up until the 15th day of Shvat. Which is, in other words, you would follow the Chanata. The Chanata is itself a question which has a very complex definition. To some, it's what's that little fruit that's there after the blossom has fallen off. It's just a tiny, tiny little. Form. What?
Swelling.
No, I mean, you can tell, like, there's a little tiny bulb there, a little tiny fruit that represents the fruit which is to be. So that would be called the Chanata Sapri. Some say it's when the blossom is still there, but they, in any event, that in and of itself is a discussion.
What?
In other words, whatever fruit came to the definition of Chanota before the 15th day of Shvat belongs to the previous year. Whatever comes to Chanota after the 15th day of Shvat belongs to the next year. With certain things, such as yirokos, with vegetables, and certain fruit, like the esrogim, you don't follow the Chanota, you follow the Lakita, you follow the time when it's picked. Whatever is picked before the 15th day belongs to the previous year's crop. Whatever you pick after the 15th day belongs to Shvat belongs to the Esrog and Yerek. So the the 15th day marks that point of demarcation, which tells us what belongs to the old and what belongs to the new. That's the halachic aspect of Chamisha Asar B'Shvat. The Mishnah tells us in Rosh Hashanah that there are times when the world is judged for certain entities, such as Pesach, the Tvua, the grains of the world, are judged. Ostensibly, whether there's going to be, whether the crop will be plentiful or will not be plentiful, whether it will be a healthy crop or it will be a feeble and a crop which will not be very nourishing. On Shavuos, on Atzeres, the world is judged for the Peiros Ilan, the fruit of the tree. Which raises the question, then, what is it that takes place on the 15th day of Shvat? If Shavuos is the time in which the decree is given out about the produce of the trees, then what precisely is it that takes place on this Rosh Hashanah of the Ilan, which is supposed to be on the 15th day of Shvat? From what we've just said, it would seem that the simplest approach would be to differentiate between the Rosh Hashanah of people, in which people are actually judged, and the Rosh Hashanah for trees, in which there is no judgment. Rather, it's a point. It's a mark in the calendar that tells us up till here belongs to the previous year, beyond this belongs to the new year, and consequently the Trumas and Maestras follow accordingly. And you would be able to give or not give from one crop on the next depending on which category it fell into. So it would have nothing at all to do with judgment, but rather is a legal index of a kind.
So it's not a Rosh Hashanah?
It is called Rosh Hashanah, but it's not the kind of Rosh Hashanah, at least from the standpoint that one should deal with it at its face value. It is not a Rosh Hashanah in which there is a judgment, for example, as there might be a judgment for fruit. On Shavuos, there is a judgment given out that has something to do with the quantity and quality of the fruit. On Pesach, there's a judgment that has to do with the quality and quantity of the grains. But here, inasmuch as it can't be a judgment of the fruit, and it's not a judgment of the people, because people are judged on Rosh Hashanah, so that leaves us with nothing to attach the concept of judgment to, and we are obliged to fall back on the fact that it is nothing other than something that tells me a point of severance of the old and the new. Between the old and the new. Svarim that comment on Chamishasa B'Shvat invariably quote the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, in which it says, "Himlich es tzadik b'le'ita," that the Almighty crowned the letter, the Hebrew letter in the alphabet, the tzadik, with le'ita. Le'ita is chewing. Chewing. We find in the commentaries that there is a concept which runs along the following lines. That there's, for example, there's a Gemara, Bungal Vayda Zohar, and elsewhere, I believe Sanhedrin, there's a Gemara which says that the world has been created to last, to endure in its current form for a period of 6,000 years. You might want to pause for a moment to remember that we are today in the 5,753rd year. So out of the lifespan of this world as we know it, we are rapidly closing in on its culmination. The world will change drastically after that point. So we are in the last millennium of this world. The Gemara also tells us that the first two millennia, the first 2,000 years, are referred to categorically as 2,000 years of Tayu. 2,000 years of a kind of anarchy, of a kind of confusion. The second two millennia are called the millennia of Terah. The beginning of the third millennium was when Avraham Avinu was in the middle of his life. And it was Avraham Avinu who initiated, by his devotion to the Almighty and his own observance and commitment of the Almighty's mitzvahs, it was he who really introduced the millennia of Torah. And it was in the year 2448, that roughly four centuries later, that the Torah was actually given to the descendants of Avram at Har Sinai. We also find that although a youngster becomes responsible legally in Jewish law when he turns 13 or when a young girl turns 12, that age marks the time in which he is subject to culpability in the law in human court. So if a youngster were to do something ritually or religiously which would constitute a violation of the Torah, he would be held accountable in a human tribunal and would be punished accordingly. However, in all of those offenses in which the Torah advises us that there is a, rather than something which is enforceable by a human court, that it is a heavenly tribunal which sentences the person, an individual is not held accountable in a heavenly tribunal until the age of 20. Now that tells us that even though an individual is held accountable or is known to be mature enough so that In those instances in which the Torah says that it is a human tribunal that should sit in judgment, on this person and on this offense, that while there is enough maturity in a 13-year-old or in a 12-year-old girl, that the individual is not yet fully seasoned, fully matured, with the kind of depth and the kind of appreciation of the gravity of certain actions until such time as they turn 20. And it's only when they reach the age of 20 that they have they are held to be mature enough, deep enough, broad enough to understand the seriousness of their deeds, and consequently can be held accountable even before a heavenly tribunal. Those two indices give us a sense of the fact that in a process of evolution or in a process of development, that it takes roughly a third of a lifetime to synthesize and integrate all of the different influences in such a way that they become something that is known to be at that point sufficiently well defined, sufficiently well articulated, that it now faces the future with a very very definite kind of configuration.
A third?
What?
A third.
So out of 6,000 years, it took 2,000 years to be able to put things together so that the world could enter the millennia of Torah. In a person's lifetime, it takes first 20 years. It's roughly a third.
A quarter.
The last 10 years are the Sabbath of a person's life. So it's, we're dealing now with, as it were, the weekdays of a person's life, or the week decade of a person's life. So it's not until he reaches 20 years old that we believe that there is over here a real configuration of what this person is all about. Within that same perspective, if we were to try to differentiate between what takes place at Rosh Hashanah and what it is that takes place at Tu B'Shvat, we would say the following. There's a pasuk in the Torah which says, "Ki ha'adam etz hasadeh." A person is likened to a tree of the field. So there's the, and this is a direct quote from pasuk in Shefti. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But what we're talking about right now is as follows. On Rosh Hashanah, we go through a very painstaking process. We review the year that was. We look back on our misdeeds. We look back on our neglect. We look back on our premeditated transgressions. We take an inventory. We try to understand the forces that shaped our lives, the forces that we did put out, didn't put out. And we go through this very agonizing process of introspection, and we emerge with a resolve. We stand before the Sovereign of the Universe on Rosh Hashanah, and we say to the Almighty, I accept your sovereign yoke upon my life. I commit myself to live in a better way than I have in the past. And we prepare for the Almighty, as it were, a brief. And that brief is a plan of action, an agenda, program for this coming year. It reflects our resolve, the kind of person that we seriously commit ourselves to be. And the Almighty will examine that resolve, both in terms of its remorse and in terms of how carefully thought out it is, how deeply committed we are to it, the things, the steps that we have taken to make that resolve achievable. And based on that, he will decree for us the shape and the destiny of the coming year. Life, God forbid, otherwise, good health, or illness, riches, poverty, what have you. The trials and tribulations, the successes, the triumphs, are decreed on Rosh Hashanah. Roughly, then, a third of the year would need to go by, which would represent the time in which our resolve is subjected to reality, to pressures, to living, going through every day, trying to transform that resolve into some actual living tissue in our lives. So that it will not be for 4 months that resolve will mature, in much the same way that the world matures in the first 2,000 years, in much the same way that a person matures in the first 20 years of his life, which is gives you some sense of the configuration of his life. Similarly, it will take 4 months before we are able to judge the reality of that resolve. The Almighty has passed judgment on the resolve. There now comes a time in which the Almighty is going to pass judgment on the acting out, the carrying out of that resolve. And so there's some question here whether or not we should count that resolve from Rosh Hashanah, or we should begin to count that third of the year from the first day of Sukkot, which is called Rishon L'Chesh Ben Avinus. It's the first day, the Medrash tells us, of a new account. So the schools of Hillel and Shammai over here differ precisely on how, from which point, which is the discussion unto itself, why each begins at a different point at the beginning of the year. The school of Shammai begins from Rosh Hashanah itself, and the school of Hillel begins from the first day of the holiday of Sukkot. But since we follow the opinion of Hillel, so if you count 4 months from the 15th day of Tishrei, you arrive at 15 days in the month of Shvat. So it's on the 15th day of Shvat that that tree, which is in human form, each one of us, ki ha'adam eitz hasadeh, is going to be judged in terms of how we have matured, how our plans have come together, how we have actually taken on the year and imposed our plan, our program, our agenda, the resolutions of Rosh Hashanah, upon the way in which we have lived up until now. anything that we do between Rosh Hashanah and Tu B'Shvat, or between Sukkot and Tu B'Shvat, to the extent that we are not yet totally seasoned, totally in place, we are engaged in this period of Tayu, we are still in this period of evolving, it really belongs to the us of last year. The deeds, in whichever way, belong to the to what we were last year. Beyond this point, go ahead.
I'm following you and everything, but I'm kind of lost with the days and the month. Everything's clear, but I kind of got lost, like where we were.
The 15th day of Tishrei is the or the, let's take it from the first day of Tishrei. That's the first day of Rosh Hashanah.
Okay.
Afterwards, you have as follows. 1 month ends would be Cheshvan. That's the next month. Next month afterward is Kislev. Next month afterward is Teves. The fourth month is Shvat. So we now have 4 months which have passed between Rosh Hashanah and Shvat, or between Sukkot, which is the 15th day of Tishrei, and the 15th day of Shvat, which is what we're really talking about. Okay, so that we're talking about the fact that between the beginning of the year, the days of our resolve, and where we are today, there is 4 months have passed, which is a third of the year. It is a third of the year which the Almighty has ordained is a legitimate period of time for the process of maturation to fully take shape, to gel into what it was that we set it out or designed it to be at the beginning. So we are, everything up until today, up until the 15th day of Shvat, which is going to be this coming Shabbos, everything up until there really belongs to the self that was.
Okay.
And what follows from beyond that day is already a product of our new selves. Now, there's nothing to say that our new selves are going to be better. We may be worse. We may have allowed our resolve to... What? To totally unravel. On the other hand, we would hope that, in fact, that we stand a few inches taller because of how we have altered the course of our lives, and that the new us, which stands in place beyond the 15th day of Shvat, is something better than that which occupied that same space a day earlier. Our resolve was judged on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Today, what's going to be judged is what we have done with that resolve.
First 4 months.
That's the conclusion of the first 4 months. We're given 4 months to put things into motion, and for the new us to appear. In other words, on the 15th day of Shvat, the curtain opens on the first act of the new year for us. This is the us that appears now.
So what was the hard thing? It was like
right. Well, it's kind of putting things together.
Dress rehearsal.
You're saying this because this quarter.
First third. It's the conclusion of the first third. Right, that's the conclusion of the first. If you count from lekachtem lechemim rishon rishon lecheshvan avonis, that's what you count as the points, and then it can the 15th day of Shvat is the conclusion of the first third. in pursuing further the way in which the definition of a person can find a certain common denominator with the tree, we will note a number of very important features. Number one, the Sforim indicate that the tree is a bridge between the earth and the fruit. The fruit grow through the tree, but then become distinct of the tree. It is the tree which draws nourishment from the roots, which are sunk deeply into the ground, which draws its nourishment from the minerals of the ground and passes it on to the fruit. And the human being is a bridge between heaven and earth. And we draw upon a physical world, a corporeal world, and we convert it such that it becomes something totally distinct, completely different kind of an entity, as it's translated into spiritual produce. So, in much the same way that a tree acts as a bridge, the human being is a connector between heaven and earth. He does things in a world which is a physical world, and yet, because there is a divine spark within him that we call the neshama, there is a fruit which is which emerges, which is nourished from and which is drawn upon this physical world, and yet it is totally distinct of and completely independent of that that earthy world. Other discussions focus upon the fact that a tree has a number of different systems. There is the part of the tree which is not seen. It's buried deep in the ground. It draws its stability from that root system. It draws its nourishment from that root system. And in much the same way, a human being has to be rooted in faith. And that the person's stability throughout life, the capacity to stand up against all the winds, the tests of one's integrity, one's value system, is completely dependent on how deep those roots are sunk in faith, how profuse is the root system. Then there is the trunk, the branches, the leaves, all of those represent a part of the tree which can be seen. Faith is not something that can be seen, so that's faith, trust, bitachon, emunah, bitachon. Those are the things that we can't see. Those are the things that are deep within a person's soul. But there are the parts that we can see. All of the different aspects of our lives, the many ways in which we express ourselves in this world. We're friends, we're children, we're parents, we're siblings, we're professionals, we have vocations and avocations. There are a great many different tributaries that make up the trunk and the branches and the leaves of our lives. And then there is the fruit. Not the part which is so much the way in which all the different limbs of our lives, but there are the things that we produce, that we actually give to the world. the sweet things that we extend to others. There is the little seeds of caring, of sustenance that we give to those who surround us. We give it in kindnesses extended. We give it to in the kinds of things that we share with them, our time, our energy, our material goods, whatever. We leave behind us the garinim. We leave behind us the seedlings. We leave behind us children and grandchildren, students, people who we have strengthened or inspired. That's another dimension. That's the fruit of our lives. So a human being is seen by the Svarim HaKadoshim of having all kinds of analogous dimensions and components about their lives, which we can gain certain insights into by looking at the tree of the field, Ki Ha'odam Eitz Hasada. One of the Sforim points out that each one of the 10 plagues corresponded to one of the months of the year. So that if we were to work backwards, if Makas Bechoros, the striking of the firstborn, took place on the 15th day of the month of Nisan, that would mean that that the plague of darkness took place on the 15th day of Adar, and that the plague of locusts took place on the 15th day of Shvat. So according to this particular viewpoint, the locusts descended upon Egypt and destroyed all of what remained of the vegetation of the land on the 15th day of Shvat. And we're just working, they worked backwards. They worked, Makas Bechoros was on the 15th day of Nisan. Choshech was on the 15th.
They actually took place.
Yeah.
Oh, not that they corresponded, but they took
no,
place.
No, it actually took place. That's when it happened.
So then it doesn't matter that two of us did not in place.
No. This is when they happened. This point of view argues that when Adam HaRishon was ushered into the Garden of Eden, that the Almighty told him that he was to eat at will, at his convenience, at his pleasure. He was to eat of any and all of the trees of the garden, with the exception of the tree of knowledge. After the same position argues that even though there's a pasuk there that would indicate that Adam was also given the grain of the land, that in reality that part of the verse refers to the animal kingdom, but that Adam was exclusively to eat the fruit of the tree. And we know that Adam violated this trust, and he ate of the tree of knowledge. And it was at that point that the Almighty said to him, you will eat of the grass of the fields. And Adam exclaimed in anguish, am I and my ox to eat of this, of the same trough? So it wasn't until there was this descent, until there was this corruption of Adam himself, that Adam joined the rest of the animal kingdom in eating of the lower forms of vegetation. But that initially, that Adam was to eat of the fruit of the tree. Now, if we understand human being initially, that Adam initially was fashioned in such a way that even his body is not what we know it today to be, which is a very extremely gashmius, extremely physical kind of thing, but that in his original shape, in his original creation, that even the body of Adam represented some lustrous, according to one opinion, literally a translucent kind of entity, which is totally unlike anything that we are familiar with in our experience today, then what we can understand is that when Adam himself had a body which was something that was meant to endure forever, which is like that body that we will be given after the Almighty will resurrect the dead, in which we will no longer be given the kind of physical body that we're familiar with today, but it will be something that will be made of a completely different type of substance, because it will be a spiritual and it will be an immortal substance, that Adam ate of the tree, or was supposed to eat exclusively of the fruit of the tree, because that was the direct corollary, that was the direct parallel to his life. Let's stop for a moment and just reflect upon a bracha. When something grows from a tree, you make a bori pri oetz. When something grows from the ground, the benediction is bori pri ha'adama. How do we know when to make a bori pri ha'adama or a bori pri ha'etz? The halachic distinction is if the entity which gives off the fruit lasts in perpetuity. For example, it does not go. You can't say, well, if it goes like 3 feet off the ground or 5 feet off the ground, then it's a bori pri ha'adama. If it's more than 5 feet off the ground, then it's a bori pri ha'etz, then it belongs to the tree kingdom. It's not the way it works. A banana grows from a very, very tall kind of a thing, something which towers above some of the trees that we're familiar with. But you do not make a bori pri ha'etz on a banana. You don't make a benediction for the fruit of the tree, because the entire stalk falls after its growing season, whatever it is. I think it's a 2-year growing season, whatever it is, number of years. But when it's finally finished with its growing season, the entire, and it must come up again from the ground. So you make a bori pri ha'adama on the banana, because it regenerates from the ground up when the new growing season starts. A tree means that the entity stands from year to year and its branches proliferate with fruit every year, but the body of the tree stands. Now, when Adam's body was supposed to be an enduring entity, and it was something that was supposed originally to have grown from year to year in its quality and excellence, and therefore the fruit of it would become more excellent, consistent with its the body of it, then Adam was only to eat of the tree, which was in some way in the kingdom of nourishment. It was that which paralleled his life. But when Adam was given a body, which now had to, at the end of its growing season, had to crumble and had to once again reemerge when the Almighty would quicken the dead, then Adam changed from being exclusively a Borei Pri Ha'etz and became a Borei Pri Ha'Adamah. There's an anecdote about one Chassid who was on his deathbed, and he was surrounded by his friends, his fellow Chassidim, and he was a man of great stature. And he said to his friends, he said, "I am about to expire." He said, "And a person only expires and gives over his soul in the lifetime but once." So he said, "I really should make a shehechiyonu, like you make a shehechiyonu, you make this bracha on something that, you know, something that comes from, that you do very rarely." What? So the bracha shehechiyonu v'kimonu v'gilonu, you allowed me to live so that I could die. But in any event, he said, "I should make a bracha shehechiyonu on the fact that this is the first time that I'm going to die." So he said, "But there's no point in doing so, because the practice is that you don't make a shehechiyonu on a Borei Pri Ha'Adamah." He says, on something which grows of the ground, you don't recite a shehechiyonu. You make it on fruit, but you don't make it on you don't make it on melons. And generally speaking, melons, the bracha is not made on anything that grows on the ground. So to the extent that Adam's body changed from being something immortal to being something that was now mortal and finite and was once again going to be absorbed by the ground and was going to have to emerge once again from the ground, Adam was therefore, after the Chet Eitz Hadas, was told by the Almighty that he was now worthy of eating from, not only from the fruit of the tree, but from the produce of the ground. So there was a second parallel in his life. There was one part of his life which remained true to the original parallel. During the course of a person's life, out of the actions that flow from his neshama, he builds an eternal entity. He is defining what he is going to look like in the world of resurrection. So he is building that tree. But there's also part of him which is like the stalk that sustains the wheat and the barley, which is going to fall and which is going to decay and decompose. What? To the extent, then, if we follow this, that the fall of man took place because of because of an appetite. The tikkun, the redress, and the reclamation of a person's integrity derives from the capacity of a person to reinstate his ability to rise above appetite. So if we are to ask ourselves the question, in what way am I going to be judged? We talk about the way in which Rosh Hashanah, I'm judged on my resolve. Tu B'Shvat, I am the tree. And I'm going to be judged for, the Almighty is going to look at the system, the roots, the trunk, the branches, the leaves. It's going to look at the health, the vitality, the vigorous aspects, or lack thereof, of that eternal structure that I am making of my life. What dimension is the Almighty going to be looking at here? What aspect of my resolve is going to be judged over here? The answer then follows that what's going to be tested over here, what's going to be judged rather, follows a fairly simple and yet very difficult principle. The principle is that no resolve at all that can change the past into something different in the future, none of that can happen unless you give up something. If you're not willing to let go of the past, then you cannot redefine the future. If you would like to be the same person that you were, doing the same things that you did in the past, then all of your resolve notwithstanding, nothing is going to change. The tree will not be any different. And that which we need to surrender, or that which we need to yield on, is our dependence upon our appetites, our conveniences, our creature comforts, our pleasures, our participation and dependence on worldly things. To the extent that we can rise above worldly things, to the extent that we are willing to let go of how much we eat, how sweet it has to be, how comfortable we have to be, in a whole variety of different ways, anything at all that has to do with a human being in his, as it were, his animal form, the part of him which is driven to follow all of those appetites. To the extent that we are locked into those appetites, we cannot redefine ourselves. So to whatever extent that we're willing to pay the premiums, to whatever extent that we are willing to give up something in deference to excellence that we would like to introduce something new, something different, something better into our lives, the price will come on our giving up something of our of what has made up part of our routine and part of our comfort and part of the appetites of our lives up until that point. Shvat, month of Shvat, and specifically Chamishasar b'Shvat, then becomes the time of judgment on how independent we have become, or, say it a little differently, how we have liberated ourselves from the dependencies upon our appetites. The Sforim go on in developing this perspective to say the following, that the antithesis of the Jewish people in the nations of the world is a nation called Amalek. The Almighty has taken an oath of eternal vengeance against Amalek, and at the end of time will annihilate them. The evil that's represented by Amalek is an evil which Amalek is defines as their credo, the essence of their lives, which is that they don't want to be in any way put out. They wish to be able to live an existence which is tied to the pursuit of pleasure, which gives in to the drives, the urges, and the appetites. They are, as the letters of the name applies, they are an Am Kal. Amalek, if you just read, what's the word? Can you, huh? rearrange. It's a transposition. Huh? No, it's, you transpose the last two letters, becomes I'm called. They're a nation who wants it easy. They want to be able to live their lives in comfort. They want to be able to pursue whatever comes quickest, that comes easily, that gives them pleasure, that allows them to enjoy the simplest things in life, in the simplest way possible. In order for us to be able to deal with the annihilation of Amalek, which is in fact celebrated in the month of Adar with Purim and the destruction of Haman, the preparation, the hachana for Mechias Amalek is a month earlier. Before the before Purim, we begin to prepare ourselves by our coming to terms with the fact that that we can rise above our appetites. And that's the reason that the fall of Haman took place at a Suda. It took place at a meal. Because that was the point of judgment of Haman, or the judgment of Purim, was a result of our willingness, Israel's willingness to participate with Achashverosh in a lavish feast of drink and eating, an orgy of self-indulgence. And when Israel was able to gain a perspective on that orgy and to divorce themselves from that and to rise above it, that marked the unraveling of Haman and the triumph of the Jewish people over Amalek. For which reason the fall of Amalek came during the course of a meal. Because it's at that meal that Haman was a slave to his appetite and Esther was a master. So Chamish Asar B'Shvat becomes a time in which we are judged about the way in which we parallel or approximate the image of man as man was intended to be. Man was intended to be Eitz HaSoda, was intended to be something which did not fall, which did not was not like a stalk of grain, which deteriorates year by year, but was intended to be something lasting and enduring and immortal. And the Almighty takes a look at the ways in which between the program that we drew up on Rosh Hashanah, which really took shape on the first day of Sukkot, and moving towards the time in which this embryonic self that we defined or that we resolved now begins to actually be articulated and emerges in something that matures into actuality. It's on this 15th day that the Almighty looks at us and says, your commitment, your resolutions are coming to fruition, and they are coming to fruition because you were willing to break with the routine of the past. You were willing to give up your dependency on all the things that were habitual, those things that which were comfortable, those things which were pleasurable to you, and you were willing to step out of the familiar and enter a new dimension that would allow you to pursue the excellence of your neshama. That's the kind of judgment that takes place on Chamisha Asar. And it's it's that judgment which this forthcoming Chamisha Asar will give us some index, some sign about how seriously we have addressed the work that we did and during the Yomim Noraim. So we still have a number of days and to look at this thing. What? Oh, right. That's the point of reference to the Sefer Yetzirah. That's Himlich Eis Tzadik Bele'ito. That the Book of Creation says that the Almighty coronated the letter Tzadik over chewing, which is to say that not only the letter Tzadik, but its point of reference in the quality of human being, which is Tzadik being a righteous, representing a righteous person, that a righteous person is someone who has become master or king of his chewing, which is symbolic of the ingestion of pleasure, the ingestion of giving in to one's appetites. So that's the way the commentaries would interpret, at least one approach to interpreting that concept in Sefer Yetzirah, that Himlichais Tzadik Bileito means that the Almighty, when he created the world, created the potential and the possibility for the righteous person to become sovereign over his appetites. So that these next few days we might spend very profitably by looking back at what we promised ourselves we would do with this coming year, the year 5753, and then ask ourselves how much of it we have actually put into action, and evaluate the extent to which those parts that we've not been able to put into action are directly attributable to the fact that we were not willing to give up part of what was our lifestyle before, and that the only way in which we can be successful is if we're willing to pay the price. And the price invariably can be traced back to the extent to which we are prepared to give up our dependence on things that were comfortable and convenient and pleasurable to us in the past.